on a cash received basis, the appropriation. So you can see there's a much bigger spread, and this is what we have to manage to, is this larger spread here with this roughly $300 million difference between where the appropriation is and the cash we're actually receiving. So this is what we're managing to. And again, with the 10,000 increase in enrollment over that 12-year period. Tuition, a very short story. We're pretty much fully billed on tuition for the last academic year, and we have full collection, pretty good, you know, very full collection. We've received the MAP money. We got the last of the MAP money in April of this year, last month, and so the last of that was received. So we're in good shape as far as tuition, and this is why I really say that tuition line is really is really cash received. This is something that the chairman wanted me to put up. It was the distributions, cash distributions to the university from the foundation. This is the last 5 years. You can see ranging from 125 up to $135 million, or generally in that 125 to 130 level. There's a couple of pieces to this. One piece is basically the amount that they pay off of the foundation, off of the portfolio. This is basically off the endowment. And what they pay is 4% of the 6-year weighted average of the portfolio. So what that number's been running is about $40 million, roughly a billion one portfolio during these market times here. So it's about $40 million. And the rest is direct gifts that come through the foundation to the university. But this is the philanthropic support, you know, coming from the foundation to the university for the past 5 years. I have two slides. This is the slide that you have in your book. This is as of March for the hospital. What this would show, and what you know, the only reason I have it in the book is because it would show about a $6.5 million operating loss. And then, as they say in Esquire magazine, a miracle happened. So the April numbers, along the lines of Dr. Garcia's presentation this morning. Now I show about $46 million operating margin in April versus Dr. Garcia would be about $15 million, you know, as of this point. And the difference is that Bill Devoney, the CFO over at the hospital, he looked at the information that was provided in our exchanges between DHFS and us, and he calculated, and there's like a $1,300 increase in the per diem rate, in the daily rate for inpatient reimbursement. And what he did is calculated based on the number of days from the beginning of the fiscal year, and he came out to that increased rate. He came out to $42 million, and he booked $42 million in there. And there is a lot of things, and when I say there's some caveats to basically this, In some of the exchanges with DHFS, they basically said that the number they thought was $29 million would be the pickup, which was Dr. Garcia used this morning. So we do have that to play out. We do have, you know, for purposes of getting this cemented down, we do have to finalize the documentation. We do have to finalize the rate notification, formalized. We have to basically conclude whether or not it is based on the 29 or how the calculation works out. But probably the most important thing, and this is where the accountants are going to jump in here, and they're going to say, show me the cash. They're going to say, you know, show me. Because when I put this down here, this basically, I put net income plus depreciation. You can see it's $45 million right now if you book that $42 million in there. Normally I would say this is basically would show what the cash is being generated by the hospital. But because all of this is receivable, all of this is, you know, it's not cash, so it's all receivable. This is just showing you net income plus depreciation is what it's just showing you, instead of, whereas last year this would have been the cash that was being generated. So I just I wanted to emphasize that. Again, this is going to have to play out, but I basically think that we do have enough going for us that with an understanding with DHFS that we can call in the financing guys and go back, and we can kind of run a parallel track of putting together a financing with final resolution of what the number is and the documentation, and also see if we can see some cash come in to basically make this a valid argument. Now, the last of my presentations is my annual very short number of metrics, financial metrics, in comparison to not only the Big Ten, but also the large publics that Moody's uses. And this is all Moody's documentation. They do this comparison every year. They're about, of course, the Big Ten, you'll notice the only one missing, of course, Northwestern is being private, is that not in there? And also Wisconsin's not in here. The reason being Wisconsin is not rated by Moody's because all of their debt is issued by the state for this, for the University of Wisconsin, so Wisconsin's not in here. We'll look at the large publics in a second, but just the Big Ten, the credit ratings, the activity since the last time we talked a year ago about this, we continue to basically have the four notch higher than the state, the A2 that the state has. We are a double A2 with Moody's with a negative outlook, totally because of the state situation, is because we have that outlook. The two other changes that happened since I last talked to you with regard to the Big Ten is the fact that Penn State got knocked down a notch because of the tragedy, the mess that they have at Penn State. And the state of Michigan was actually knocked down a notch. But Michigan State and, of course, Michigan were not knocked down as a result of the state being knocked down. Of course, Michigan operates on a separate constitutional basis from the state of Michigan, so it really operates on a separate basis. But even there, they're three notches higher than the state rating of Michigan. The other AAAs, basically Indiana and Purdue, they basically have the same rating as the state of Indiana. The only one that's basically under the other besides Penn State now is Iowa. It's a AAA state, and it's a double A2. Now we're gonna have some comparisons not only to the Big Ten, but also to the list of large public universities, about 10 slides coming up here. There are about 33 institutions that make up, or universities that make up, this median. And it's not a dollar benchmark to get into this large public median. It's generally the flagships, they're the systems, they're the land grants, and you'll see that it has all the Big Ten that I've already shown except for Wisconsin. And it does have a number of the other ones that we're gonna, Rutgers, who will be joining us, will be on our Big Ten screen. Also Maryland, who next year will be on our Big Ten screen as they join the Big Ten. Mr. President, I'm pleased to see that Texas A&M is in comparison, and so but again, these are the land grants, the flagships, the state systems. There, but you can see there's a good representation in this public meetings. And again, this is all Moody's. These are all Moody's metrics that I've just lifted, right from Moody's. The Big Ten comparison. When you take a look at us, being essentially a $5 billion operation. Similar in size to Ohio State and Penn State. Of course, Michigan with being a much bigger institution. Some of the driving forces in that, we continue the blue. We probably still have the highest amount of state support of the other universities, the Big Ten universities. You can see in red, the research really pops out as being, red is the research component, and you can see that really pops out as a big contributor to the revenues. All of this is basically the diversity of revenues that the rating agencies look at, and they know that we're not fully relying on one thing. The green, I think that this is really where it pops out. You can see that basically is our academic medical center, and you can see just the preponderance of, at Michigan of their medical center. You can also see the importance of there, but also at Ohio State, it's a major component of the revenues is the medical center at those institutions, and it's our size. This purple is basically, this is tuition and auxiliary costs, and you can see that, and you'll see it bears out more that Penn State and Ohio State and Michigan, some of the bigger ones, but that's based on size, is Purdue and Indiana, almost having half of their revenues coming from tuition and auxiliaries. So now we'll go into these comparisons. I think that these are some of the key items, about 45 list of metrics that we take a look at. I think these are the key ones, and again, these are the same ones I saw I gave to the University Senate, so you'll see that hopefully it's the exact same thing that you saw. Again, for cash and investments, this is as of June 30th of 2012, the last audited information for the universities, that we were right at the the median for both the publics. We had clawed our way up to the median for both the publics and the Big Ten. Certainly the outliers, again, are Ohio State, and I'll talk about, you know, they've always been an outlier. Penn State has been also been, you know, a lot of, always had a lot of cash on their balance sheet. And of course, Michigan, really driven by their medical center, is basically a monumental amount of cash just at their medical center. So you can see that. But what we've done is basically clawed our way up to essentially the median, so both for the Big Ten and for the large publics. But more of a measure of ability to pay the bills is cash on hand. We are still lagging. We are at 151 days. The large public median was 170 days, which is the red line, and the Big Ten is 204 days, is the days cash on hand. And again, this is a measure of ability to pay the bills. Again, you can see that size, again, in comparison, you can see where Ohio State stands. And again, you can see Penn State always has had a very high, they have almost 380 days of cash on hand to pay their bills at Penn State. Purdue also is very high, but it's also a measure of the size here for Purdue. Again, talk about our resources, our reserves, but unrestricted financial resources to operation. This is basically the ratio of what we have on hand in our reserves to pay, you know, for versus our operation size. There is something called the primary reserve ratio. The target, you know, for being, you know, for this is put up by the U.S. Department of Education, for one, is basically between 30 and 40, a factor of 30 or 40, 0.3 or 0.4, between 0.3 and 0.4. We are at 2.23, so we still have a ways to go in order to get up into that. You can see that the large public median is at 0.33, and the Big Ten, but it gets distorted by some of these individual players, but is at 0.44 in the Big Ten. But the target for this is usually about 0.4 would be the target, but try to get into the 3 to 4 area for this ratio. The debt comparison, you can see that we have about $1.7 billion in debt outstanding. Michigan's just about the same at $1.8 billion. And our friends at Ohio State have $2.4 billion outstanding. And the reason is they were one of these guys that went out and sold $1 billion of 100-year bonds. You know, they just went out and, sent a, you know, and basically said, I'll worry about it in 100 years, you know. So they did that with the blessing of the state legislature in Ohio, you know, when they did that. So that's, you know, that's what that spike is for Ohio State. Again, the components very quickly for what makes up our debt. You can see we are, you know, right up at the Big Ten median, but the Big Ten median has been pushed up much higher. The Big Ten median has been pushed up much higher because of the Ohio State situation. But the large public median is only about $1.1 billion in debt. We have $1 billion of auxiliary debt. This is revenue debt we use to build our housing, our rec centers, our food services, about $1 billion there, all paid from auxiliary funds. We have another $500 million in certificates of participation, which we use for purposes of renovation of our academic buildings and to help our academic buildings. And the debt service for those come right out of the operating funds of the budgets of the individual campuses where it happens. And then the last roughly $100 million is about $60 million of hospital debt, another $50 million of tax increment financing over here from the South campus development, and some amount of ESCOs, these energy savings contracts. But you can see that we are have used debt, and probably the rest of them, the ones that are this lower level, probably can get greater assistance from the state for purposes of, you know, their academic buildings. And again, this is against the background of essentially, other than 2010, essentially having really nothing as far as capital dollars coming from the state for a decade plus. Other thing is we're very conservative issuers of debt. We basically approve that what this means, debt service coverage. This proves that what we do is make sure that we basically have revenues on hand that in case the direct revenue source gets in trouble, that we basically have a backup of pledged revenues that would pay the debt. And we're over six times, we're at about 6.4 times our debt service. For example, let's just take the existing hospital debt. We not only pledge the revenues of the hospital, we also pledge the MSP, and we also pledge the College of Medicine's revenues to basically. So we basically, that's how you have a higher level of debt service coverage than just the pure debt service. This is always an interesting one, and you can argue with the calculation that Moody's uses, the way they calculate net tuition per student. In our case here, $10,659. At Penn State, for instance, $17,761. The large public median, which is, again is the red line, $11,855, and the Big Ten median, $12,051. And then the calculation, and you can basically play with it as you wish, is they take right off our P&L, they take net tuition, and they subtract off waivers, and we have a big amount of waivers, some $225 million of waivers, and they subtract that, and then they just divide that by the number of students enrolled, both undergraduate and graduate, that 77,000 number that in the fall of 2011, enrolled students, and that's how they do this calculation. So you can pick it apart, but that's how Moody's basically, and then for purposes of this comparison, that's how they do it. And again, they do it the same for every institution because they pick the same number off the same place on the financial statements. My last two, please hold your applause. There's really just a matter of looking at demand that the rating agencies look at as far as demand for the university. Again, they call this primary matriculation. It's admissions to applications. Our level of admissions to the applications that we take in. In our case, for the university, 34%. It's essentially right at the Big Ten median. The large public median is about another point higher, 35%. You can see the outlier without any comment is Nebraska. And the last slide, looking at acceptances to applications. Again, we are right at the large public median. We're at 65%, and the Big Ten median is 63%. So we're right at, we're right at the Big Ten median for acceptances. These last two slides are really just measures that the rating agencies use for demand for the university and when they do their analysis. End result was we did maintain that AA with a negative outlook from Moody's, and we were able to maintain a AA- with a stable outlook from Standard & Poor's as a result of this information and these comparisons.
Questions? Just a question on the rating. You're talking about going out and pursuing the bonds that we've delayed. That's assuming that we don't get a further reduction.
Well, I think the current hospital bonds are rated an A1, not the AA2, and we just have to try to put our best foot forward. We certainly have to have the Medicaid situation firmed up. And we have to, so we can make some good projections. One of the things that we have to concern ourselves with that Dr. Garcia talked about is the future, and basically how the shift from fee-for-service to managed care and how that's going to affect us as far as our take, how the Medicare adjustments will affect us, because when you look at our payer mix, those are all key components of our payer mix. So we'll give it the old University of Illinois try.
Further questions? Very good. Thank you all. Appreciate it. I think what we'll do is make an adjustment on the agenda. And Avijit, why don't you come up and cover pension, and then Tom Farrell, wherever you are, we'll come back and do foundation. So I think it'd be a good timing for you to cover it now after the fall.
Thank you, sir. Members of the Board of Trustees, for 2 years now, you have been reading the newspaper about pension reform legislation. And since Vice President Noah spoke, we have 23 less minutes. We have only 57 hours, 21 minutes left this year to try to do some pension reform legislation.
Won't use that much time.
So all employees of state universities and community colleges belong to the State University Retirement System. And preponderance of them belong to one of three different retirement plans. One which is known as a Tier 1, which is a traditional defined benefit plan. This was a plan for everybody who joined prior to January 1, 2011. On January 1, 2011, a new plan was put in, which is called a Tier 2 plan. So anybody who joined after that date and chose a defined benefit plan is a member of the Tier 2 program. And then there's a defined contribution plan, which is like a traditional 401k, 100% defined contribution plan. These are the three plans that are in operation. So there's been a lot of discussions about how this pension system gets reformed such a way to bring greater fiscal stability to the whole pension system. There are obviously five pension systems in the state which has been dealing with. We'll focus today mostly on SUSE, which is the State University Retirement System to which we all belong. There have been a number of different proposals, plans, bills that have been put forward on pension reform, and basically all of those bills tend to deal with four different elements, or at least some of these four elements. And one is sort of Tier 1 benefit changes is how the defined benefit program of those who are in Tier 1, how that will be redefined going forward. Then also about Tier 2, in essentially how the pension program itself would be reformed. Then the other component is the amortization of liability. This, of course, you know, is the crux of the issue that most of these pension programs are not funded at the level that they should be funded. They're highly underfunded. So part of this reform proposal has to be how those underfunding is going to be made up, how that liability is going to be amortized over time. And then there's a fourth element in most of this plan, which is typically referred to as normal cost shift. We will discuss this in a little bit more greater because right now the House is debating a bill that will affect the normal cost shift. Right at this moment, there are two active bills. One is a House amendment to Senate Bill 1, which was passed on May 3rd. Quite often, newspapers refer to it as the Speaker's Bill. And then there is the Senate Bill 2404, passed on May 9. The newspapers often define this as the President's Bill, President Culleton Bill. So there are these two contending bills that are out there. It is not very clear at all what will be the final outcome in the next 2 days. There are a lot of different speculations, but I will stay away from that. Both of these bills only deal with the Tier 1 benefit change and amortization. Neither of those two other two elements, the Tier 2 or the normal cost share, are dealt with in these two bills. Okay. There's a separate normal cost bill which is being debated, as I mentioned earlier. So the House bill, what it does, it changes a number of the different elements of the benefit package right now, such as retirement age. Then it changes the annual annuity increases, which is the cost of living adjustments that are done each year. It puts a cap on the pensionable salary, which means there's a cap on what portion of the salary is used for calculating an annuity. And then it also changes the employee contribution. And all of those changes become effective on enactment of this bill. So for example, the current retirement age is 60 years. What it does, it says that people who are above 45 years, there will be no change. People who are below 35 years, it will be changed by 5 years. And then there's incrementally, it will change for the people in between. The portion that gets, or the element that gets discussed quite a bit is this annual annuity increase, or COLA. Right now, retirees get a 3% compounded COLA increase each year. What this proposes is that that increase will start 5 years after retirement or the age of 67, whichever is first, and that the maximum annual increase will be $900. Obviously, this is a provision that not only affects current employees, but it will also affect current retirees. The third element of that bill is a cap on pensionable pay. Again, the pensionable pay is capped at a Social Security wage limit. The Social Security wage limit is around $110,000 a year right now. It increases each year, but right now it's about $110,000. In 2014, it becomes $113,000. So if you're earning less than that, then you will get full benefits until you reach that income level. But if you're above that limit, then essentially for pension purposes, your wages will be considered to be fixed at that level, even if you get merit increases, merit salary increases in the future and things like that. So that's what that pension cap is trying to do. And then the final element in that bill, or final main element in that bill, is asking for employees to contribute more. Increase it from 8% to 9% in FY14, and then to 10% in FY15 and post FY15. So these are the ways in which the Senate Bill 1 affects the retirement package. Then the new Senate Bill 2404, it takes a slightly different approach. Instead of simply making changes to the benefit package, it will offer individuals a set of three options to choose from. And each of those options a different combination of cost of living index, cost of living increases, additional contribution, principal salary. But it also includes in this, as a part of this package, access to retiree health care. So that's a new element that's introduced in this portion. So for example, here are the three options. As you can see in option B, which is the default option, the middle one, if you don't choose any, this is where you'll fall. The cost of living adjustment stays at 3% compounded, the way it is right now, but you lose access to retiree health care. And no future salary increases are included in benefits, even if you are lower than the Social Security wage limit. So whatever is the salary you're earning now, it is frozen at that. So you can see if somebody is just starting their careers, essentially, you've taken away the retirement benefit for the future. And then option C includes, you can keep many of these benefits, but you pay more, and then pensionable. And then option A, the cost of living adjustment is simple instead of compounding. So there's a different combinations. Employees will be given until May 31st, 2014 to choose one of these three options, which would become effective on July 1st, 2014. So these are the two different plans that are currently active bills. We'll have to see which happens, or some have speculated that within the next 57 hours there'll be some compromise and maybe somehow an amalgam of two plans will come together, or a completely different plan will be proposed in between now and then, which is something we'll have to wait and see. Both of these plans also deal with this amortization of unfunded liabilities. In the Speaker's plan, that goes a little faster. SUSE currently is funded approximately 42% of where they should be. And the target in both cases is try to get substantial funding in the next 30 years. In the speaker's plan, it would reach 100% funding in 2045. In the Senate President's bill, it would reach 90% funding in 2045. And there are also clauses which requires the state to make these payments and grants the retirement system certain rights to sue the state if they do not pay. Okay. I will leave it to the lawyers to decide what that right actually means in practice. As I said, there is a separate discussion about normal cost shift. Normal cost is the annual cost of pension for benefits that have accrued that year. So each year, every individual employee gets some benefits as a part of the retirement package. And the normal cost is essentially the accumulation of those costs. So right now, for example, the state, the employer portion of normal cost is 11.09%. Sorry, not right now, in FY14, it'll be 11.09%. And then the employees are paying 8%, so the total cost is 19% of pay. Around 19% of the pay is the cost of offering the retirement benefit package. So the state is now paying 11.09% in FY14. What the proposal is to gradually transfer this normal cost to the direct employees. So if either the University of Illinois, all the public universities, community colleges, they will absorb this normal cost. We have had a number of discussions with different states, including the president, with the speaker and others about this, and we have been able to prevail in convincing them to transition it in a slow pace and not try to put all the cost burden very directly in a very short period of time, because that's a substantial cost for the university to take over. So the agreement now is that the gradual transfer to the university will start in FY15 and will be at a rate of 0.5% of pay a year. So in FY15 we'll pay 0.5% of pay, FY16 will pay 1% of pay, then 1.5%, and will go up till the entire normal cost is transferred to the university. So natural question you might have is, so what's the maximum? Is it 11.09%? How many years will it take? Each 0.5% is equivalent to $4.34 million on state funds in today's money for the university. And then another about $3 million on auxiliary funds. Okay. So altogether about $7.3 million. Each 0.5% represents about $7.3 million. So the first year we'll have to pay $7.3 million, next year $14.6 million, and so forth. Now how much do we have to pay? One of the things that we also have to look at in trying to project how much we will ultimately have to pay at the maximum is that the normal cost projection actually goes down each year. So if you see, this is the normal cost projection till 2026, the employer portion of the normal cost projection until 2026, at which time it reaches 6.9%. And by that time, in that sort of cumulative taking 0.5% a year, the university's portion has reached about 6%. And then the normal cost drops to about 6.5%. So I think we can say that the maximum university will probably pay is approximately 6.5% of pay if today's benefits prevail. This is based on today's benefits. So if benefits are changed, normal costs might go down. If benefits are reduced, if benefits are increased, normal costs will go up. But of course, all projections can change due to actual assumptions. So it's not only normal costs that we are assuming, we are also assuming a certain risk that if these projections turn out to be not right, then there'll be unknown liabilities that we'll have to pick up, okay? It is specified that any unknown liabilities created that way, universities will have to retire those, amortize those on a 30-year straight line amortization. Okay. So it's unknown liability we're also picking up. Now, related to this, one of the issues that we have discussed is that if normal costs are going to be transferred to the universities, there are certain other things that need to happen. One of the biggest risks, of course, to the university is that as universities take over the cost of this, who retains control of the plan itself? It'll be easy for people to change the plan because if they don't have to retain control over the financing of that plan. So what we have asked for is university control over future changes to the plan. So what is proposed in the draft bill that we have seen is that if any changes are made to the benefits by the General Assembly, it will have to come to the University Board of Trustees to accept or reject, and each university can accept or reject any proposed change that increases cost.
That's in the terms of either bill?
No. This the cost transfer bill is a standalone bill. Okay. It's a standalone bill. We have also the composition, the SUS board is proposed to be changed. Right now there is no representative of the employer in a sense. So going forward there will be three representatives from the universities and three representatives from the community colleges to be nominated by the presidents of the universities and the trustees of community colleges. We have also requested stability in general revenue appropriations, which you have heard earlier that there's a possibility that there we will receive stable GRF allocation. We've also asked for relief from a number of different kinds of regulation that really sort of impede on our efficiency with which we can do our activities. And we believe that there will be some consideration to that. And the bill, draft bill again includes some, including on the procurement side, some changes that will make it much easier for us to do what we do. This is where we stand today. As I said, we will probably know somewhat more by this evening, and then probably a lot more by Friday. I would be happy to take any questions.
And ask all questions as you want to, because the VJ's going to pass out a quiz. So you can all test your knowledge.
I have a quick question.
But the answers change by the minute.
Yeah, that's right.
I have a quick question about the new spots on the SUS board. You said three university spots?
Yes.
So, but that's throughout the state?
Yeah, the way that in the SUS board, the current composition is that there are six elected members, and then members appointed by the government, and then a separate appointment for the chair of the board, which will be changed. The six elected members will still stay. And then there will be three members appointed who are representatives of universities, nominated by the university president, and three members appointed who will represent the community college.
So there's no guarantee that the University of Illinois, per se, would have a representative on the board. It would just be
no
sort of in the mix.
You're right, there's no guarantee. I suppose I can say there's an expectation.
We'll put your name forward, though, if you like.
Well, the other big change that we also made is that currently no member of the school system can be nominated to the board, and that is being changed also so that any member of the university could be nominated also.
Further questions? Complex issue. I just want to comment to Abhijit. Abhijit and I have been talking off and on about this for a year and a half. And Bob, I know you've been involved in many discussions. The representation from the university in this whole discussion and both the executive and legislative branch has been staggered. And I just appreciate all your efforts. I know it's frustrating trying to get to the bottom of it, but I really appreciate all the efforts that you've put into it.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you. We have Tom Farrell coming up next, but I think that Jim Montgomery probably needs a bio break, so I think we'll take a very brief bio break.
Thanks, Jim.
5 minutes. 5 minutes. Got to come back.